Let's go. Let's welcome everybody to Planet Pit and show them what worldwide music is.
Call me Mr. Worldwide.
Let's show them why they call me Mr. Worldwide.
Why you think they call me Mr. Worldwide?
Let's show them why they call me Mr. Worldwide.
Hold up, 'cause bitch, I'm worldwide.
Hi everyone, welcome to Friends in Hell, episode 4. I apologize that it has been taking me so long. I just started school, senior finally, and I've been not doing anything. I've been too busy. Well, I've got a new guest. You know, I have a guest every time I have my show. But I have one of my heroes in animation. I have a lot of heroes in different things. I have, of course, in comedy, I have Robin Williams. I have the gentleman here I'm having tonight, today, I have Paul Rugg, in action films, Schwarzenegger, Stallone. In real life, I got my dad. But this man is named John P. McCann. He was the writer, if you don't know the name of it, he was the writer of Freakazoid, which is one of my favorite shows that we're going to talk about. We're going to bother him about that. And our other favorite show will be Peaky the Wayne and Animaniacs. He started his career in as comedy and then just started going to cartoons. I grew up watching this man's work, and I love it, and I think it's one of the greatest writing, in my opinion. Most people think that it's just, oh, it's just cartoons, but actually this is very important animation because it is pure beauty of writing. Mr. McCann knows how to write and be funny. This man is a stand-up guy. Thank you, John P. McCann, once again, for being on this program. I found him via Facebook, and I found him, and I asked him if he wanted to be on my show. I thought he would never answer. But in a week, less than a week, he contacted me back. He goes, you know what? I'll be on the show. I'll give you a date. Today, it is Thursday, August 28th, 2014, and I'm going to have John P. McCann on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my good buddy and my hero, John P. McCann. Everyone, welcome to Friends in Hell. I am with my good buddy, John McCann. How are you, sir?
Good, Kevin.
Good.
Good to talk to you again.
Oh, yeah, of course. Most of my audiences are, well, depending. I don't know how many audiences I have. I only did four of these shows. I do what I like. And so I haven't done that much of celebrity. And I have, like I said, one of my heroes, John P. McCann, who wrote great animation. How did you get started in animation, if I may ask?
Well, I didn't start out looking for animation. It sort of found me. I was doing improvisational comedy, you know, like Saturday Night Live. You know, we'd write sketches and then we'd perform them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then in between, we'd make up sketches based on audience suggestions. You know, like Second City or groups like that. Anyway, one of our director, his wife was working for Warner Brothers. Her name was Sherry Stoner, and yep. She was working on Tiny Toon Adventures. And she said they'd be, you know, they needed more writers, so she got me a Tiny Toon script. And then when they did Animaniacs, they gave me what they call a pilot script, you know, to test me out and see if I knew the characters. So Paul Rugg and I, you know, both got pilot scripts and they liked them enough to hire us. So that put us in the door at Warner Brothers and on we went from there.
Cool. Cool. How difficult was it to write for animation when you first started? Because it's different than just writing a slapstick comedy. Because in animation, you're dealing with cartoon characters, not dealing with real people.
Right. Well, you have to be aware of the medium. In other words, if you're writing for animation, everything must be drawn by artists who are under a deadline.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they got a director breathing down their neck. So, you know, if you call for a crowd shot of 200 people, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to, you know, they just don't have the time. So over time, we had to sort of gradually learn what the, you know, where the limits were on animation and what was good to do and what worked well and what didn't, but mostly they just wanted, you know, people who could write quickly and hopefully funny stuff. So we could do those, but over time we picked up you know, what it was to work in animation.
And then you worked on Animaniacs, which was meant to be a sequel, but also as a continuous series for Tiny Toons. Then when you guys worked on Animaniacs, correct?
I am not sure.
Not sure.
Well, I know that because they had a lot of different characters, so I think they wanted to kind of keep the same feel but go in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
So people like Peter Hastings and Sherry Stoner and Deanna Oliver had been working on developing Animaniacs along with Tom Ruger for a few months. And then when they finally had the characters that they thought they would roll with, that's when we got the call to try and write a Warner Brothers script and see what that looked like.
Cool.
So they had no idea how they would play out on paper. Mm-hmm. So we were among the guinea pigs to give it a go.
Hey, at least you did it.
Yeah.
Was Mr. Spielberg involved highly in there? Because I know that I heard some interviews. Paul Rugg said that Spielberg always gave his information, did you always hear that he always said yes, I like this episode, or no, work on this better, or
not always. He was involved, as he was involved with Tiny Toons, but. Mm-hmm. You know, he was making movies. He was making like Hook, Schindler's List, and Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
So he'd be on a movie set and he would fax us back information saying, you know, he'd read the scripts and he liked them. But, you know, he wouldn't micromanage. You know, he'd give suggestions, but he wouldn't insist that it be, you know, shoehorned in.
Mm-hmm.
He was very open to letting Tom and the rest of the folks create this show, and if he liked something, he'd say it, which was, I thought, pretty decent of him.
Very cool. I wasn't around when the other cartoons were around, like Freakazoid when it first debuted, or Tiny Toons or Animaniacs, but when I grew older, I would watch them. And my favorite of what you did was Freakazoid. How did Freakazoid get created? Because I heard Bruce Timm and Paul Dini got into the project, and then they left, and then they just gave it to you guys.
Yeah, it had started out something completely different. It was going to be more of an edgy superhero, you know, still in the mold of traditional superheroes, but with a dark sense of humor, perhaps. Uh-huh. And I know Dini and Bruce Timm were putting it together, and it really wasn't. Steven was giving notes, Spielberg, and he wanted it funnier, wilder, more blown out.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't really Bruce Timm's, cup of tea. So eventually, you know, they were, Superman was in the works at the time, and they went off to do that. And then they gave it to Tom Ruger, and he brought in Paul and I, to take it in a different direction. So we just figured the gloves are off. So we had some fun with it.
It wasn't true. You guys had a strict deadline and you guys had no idea about the character. You guys had to do like a garage clicker, which was the original origin for Freakazoid, which I heard on the DVD.
Yeah. It was how does he go from Dexter Douglas to Freakazoid? And so we had no idea, you know, and we're thinking, you know, do garage clickers set him off? You know, if you open a can of tuna for the cat, will that do it? You know, what makes this guy change? And Tom Ruger eventually said, does it really matter? You know, just have him change. And I think Paul came up with having him go into the computer and come out and just switch at the word, you know, freak out, or the phrase freak out, which simplified everything.
In the first episode of Freakazoid, they have, after Dance of Doom, you have what kind of like the where Animaniacs were, and like the tie-in song, and there were all these characters of Freakazoid, but some of them were not used.
Right.
Yeah.
Though a lot of them were from the early development.
Uh-huh.
They were developed by Paul Dini and Bruce Timm. Like you'll see this scarecrow-like gunfighter character there, Kid Carrion.
Mm-hmm.
He never actually got his own episode. But he did show up in the background. In other words, they'd spent all this money developing it, and so there was some pressure to sort of, put him in somewhere and justify the development. So
uh-huh.
You know, Longhorn, I guess he got a couple episodes, but yeah, there were probably a few others that didn't actually, never made it. Somebody called Major Danger, you know, who was this crazed Jumanji-like hunter who was chasing down Freakazoid. He never really got an episode of his own. And there were a few more that we came up with that never saw the light of day, but you know, that's the way it rolls.
Yeah. How difficult was it just to be start off with Freakazoid? Of course, like just like you did the other shows, with Freakazoid, you had you had a strict deadline, and I heard Paul say that they had no idea what to do, so you guys had to put advertisements saying, "We don't know what we're doing, so we better get back to work."
Well, we did, I think, throw some of those things in, but I know Paul or Tom Ruger had a script that he had written initially that contained that was a number of just small bits. The Boron was one of those, and a couple others. And so we ended up using that, using a lot of the material that he had, just to get us started because we were under a deadline, and you know, kind of build it from there. Mm-hmm. So we like the idea of the small kind of you know, just throwaway little moments. You know, it was very much sketch comedy, where mm-hmm. you know, you just do something, you know, hopefully get a laugh and move on.
Yeah.
So Tom's script was a great help in getting us started.
Mm-hmm. I'd rather watch the old cartoons that you wrote with Freakazoid than the new ones, because of course I'm 18. I just watch them because I want to be an animator, so I learn. And I see yours, and you have stuff like from Ed Wood. You have stuff from like from Jerry Lewis. Things that most people nowadays have no idea. So you guys got influenced by everything.
Yeah, we figured, you know, because the character was so manic, we figured he just grabbed things from the ether, you know, whatever he heard. So, you know, Ed Wood had, I think, been popular right around that time. So we threw some lines in. Mm-hmm. You know, Paul Rugg had done Jerry Lewis on stage, you know, mm-hmm. had done versions of it in improv. So, you know, it was easy for him to, when he was improvising, to just kind of grab that character and put him in. So we figured it wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
You know, and we certainly didn't imagine it would still be floating around years later.
Yeah.
No one knew how the internet was going to play out.
Yeah. Before the DVD came out in 2008, I had to watch it on the internet. Because I remember bits of the show when I was little. And I'd say, I want to watch the program. So I would watch it like bits, because they didn't have full episodes. Until I saw in the commercial, Freakazoid on DVD was coming out. How did you feel about that when you said, finally, it's coming on DVD?
Well, it was mostly a business deal why it never came out. Because at the time, DreamWorks and Amblin Entertainment were associated with Warner Brothers. But mm-hmm. then when they founded DreamWorks and moved away, they both still owned Freakazoid, Animaniacs, and these others.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't a clear-cut ownership. So they couldn't really go to DVD until they'd worked that out. But then eventually, they finally got the details ironed out, and Warner's was able to release them. So I was happy to see mm-hmm. it finally see the light of day.
I had to go to 4 stores to try to buy it. I made my mom drive me, because they didn't have it at Target. I had to go to 2 Circuit Cities. They didn't have it. Walmart didn't have it, so I went to the last Circuit City of town. I finally got it, and I watched the whole show. So. Cool.
Thank you for your perseverance.
No problem, sir. No problem. After you worked on Freakazoid, you had 2 seasons on that show, correct?
Yes.
Was there a chance to go 3rd season, or you thought that the viewers weren't into Freakazoid, or was there a business situation going on at Warner Bros. At that time, or?
Yeah, there was never a chance it would go 3. It mm-hmm. had barely made 2. Because it was.
Some people didn't understand the jokes or didn't get the why Freakazoid ran with his arms like going like this or something like that.
Yeah, it basically came down to the WB put it on at 8 o'clock in the morning, mm-hmm. which, you know, our viewership wasn't even in bed yet by then. So, you know, it was a tough slot. And then they moved it to 3:30 during the week. And, you know, they didn't really get it. So they didn't really know where to put it. And finally, they just sold it to Cartoon Network. I think we had about two episodes left, or maybe four. They sold it to the Cartoon Network, and I think they showed the last episodes there.
And that's where I remember watching it from. I used to watch it in Cartoon Network. Who created Emmett? I remember every single time there's always this little short guy in every scene you see, like in Heroes Who Lunch, or the Jewish superheroes are with, and then you see Emmett standing outside. Who created?
Yeah, that was Mitch Schauer, who was the producer on the first season. Yeah, he was a pretty funny guy, and so he thought of Emmett, and you know, sort of like Where's Waldo, just put him in everywhere.
And what about the fake actors you always put on there? You put like the Hopping Woman, and all those.
Wena Mercator.
Who would you? Was that something you just made up just to put on the show quickly, or would you say, you know what, I'm gonna put these fake actors on just to put them on?
The second part.
The second part.
Yeah, I just said, you know, that sounds like a pretty funny name, and I think Ronnie Del Carmen was the director on Dance of Doom, and he wanted to actually have a Hopping Woman.
Oh, what do we
go under the bottom of the screen? And I said, you know, why don't we pass on that? Because I think the viewer's imagination will supply that. We can't do any better. So, you know, we just let that stand as it was. And I think she came back a couple other places too.
Very cool. What would you do? What are you doing currently now? Are you working on anything new?
Working on a bunch of ideas. I'll be pitching them to Disney sometime in September. So just to see what they'll, you know, see what flies over there.
Cool. I try to pitch one thing here at the animation. There's an animation studio here in North Carolina, in Charlotte. And I showed them one of my drawings. Said, oh, yeah, sure, we'll call you later. I haven't been called once. It's been like 4 months. I say, yeah, you know what, I don't care. I'll just draw and beg people for jobs.
Welcome to showbiz, Kevin.
Yeah. I tried to call John Crispolusi. I couldn't get anything. I said, oh, well, I'll just go to college and wait for now.
Just keep drawing, you know, working on your characters, thinking of stories, you know, where can you put them? Who'd be a funny character to play off this guy? You know, what do they want? You know, just real basic stuff. Keep working on it.
The problem for me is when I write, and I think you probably have this, that some of the stuff as like we think has already been created. And sometimes you have trouble with, oh, I'm going to do this, but wait, this guy or this cartoon does exactly the same thing you're thinking of. So how difficult is that for you as a writer?
That happens. You know, what I find I do more is, you know, if I have a title or a name or you know, an idea, a lot of times I'll Google it to see if anything has come up. You know, stories are, you know, timeless. You're always going to see the same story, you know, on revenge or, you know, fitting in or, you know, peer pressure. You're going to see stories like that. It's how you treat them that is really, you know, what makes the difference and the characters who are dealing with it.
That's cool. Folks, just as FYI, I became friends with Mr. McCann on Facebook. I didn't think he would even accept my friend request, or wasn't even sure that was a real guy. And once I found out and I asked him, he actually said, sure, no problem, I'll be on the show. And I said, I was bored, so I drew a Freakazoid drawing, and I sent it to Mr. McCann, and the coolest thing, and I have it printed out, he says, very nice work, Kevin. I thought that was cool, when the producer tells me that the drawing I did was cool. So that was cool. When you worked on, let's say, a show, how long does it take for you to start off your first draft or end to the end of the end of the episode? Do you keep on going separate drafts, or you go just like you keep on one draft, or?
Yeah, it depends. If I'm story editing, then I might have to work on somebody else's script at the same time that I'm working on an original script. So once you go into production, then you have deadlines. In other words, each script has a production deadline, and you've got artists, you know, and the crews working on the props and the backgrounds and the characters and things like that. So they have to be fed. So you can't, you know, you can't dawdle. You got to get your script in when you say you're going to get it in. And if you're editing someone else's, you have to get it in. Often on Freakazoid, we try and, the second season, we try and work it so that every 10 days to 2 weeks, we'd have a script due. So that gave us time to edit, story edit any other scripts we were working on, and then complete an original of our own.
How was the powers that be reacting to the show when it first came out? Oh, Freakazoid. I know that I heard that Jim McCurdy liked it and they supported you. And then after, and then I heard that some people, like after she left, some people weren't treated as right in cartoons.
Well, Jean was a rarity in that she was really, she really trusted the people that she hired. And, you know, she would look over the stuff and she'd have opinions, but she wouldn't micromanage. And she loved the energy of Freakazoid and loved the way we took it, but knew that it would be a tough sell to the network and everything else. That's why we had to do sort of half-hour stories for the second season. But ultimately, she couldn't, you know, it wasn't her call by then. So it was up to the WB, and they didn't care for it, and they weren't going to order or pay for a second season. So, you know, Jean was great with all the shows there, and she was a big part of why Warner Brothers Animation was as, you know, freewheeling as it was back then.
Very cool. When you work on, like, let's just say someone gives you an idea and say, okay, I'm going to give you an idea of this guy. All right. What's your first reaction? Do you say, do you start listing, oh, he likes cake, he doesn't like cake, I give him this, I give him that, and then you start an outline, or do you just draft and put put words on paper?
Well, it depends. Now, in Freakazoid, for example, we had all these leftover characters from the development, you know. So I wrote up, I wrote something on Longhorn.
Yes.
So I was trying to think of what I could do with him. And, you know, Longhorn seemed to say, you know, Texas, Old West, you know, that sort of thing. So somehow I got this Johnny Cash voice in my head, and I gave it to him.
Yeah.
And it just seemed to play out. But I already had an image there to look at. There was artwork. So that, you know, what the artist had done inspired me. So I was able to, you know, come up with my own take on it.
But the original Longhorn, I think there's shots online that he was actually a human with horns just like that from the Bruce Timm development. And then when you guys worked on it, he was actually like an animal with long horns.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, the artist, you know, might have toyed with it and taken it in a different way that would make it look funnier, you know, than Bruce Timm. A lot of the Bruce Timm characters had this, you know, kind of really high, edgy tension to them.
Yeah.
And, Freakazoid certainly had that initially in the drawings, and like a lot of the villains did.
Like, he had veins, I remember. Like, I think the one I drew had veins, too. So I drew him, like, real, like, he was real big. He was bigger than what he was. I think the original one, he was, like, broad-shouldered, almost Batman-like. And this one, he was all slim.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like he was chewing on a piece of rebar, you know, in the Bruce Timm ones. But, you know, they wanted something dramatically different.
Yeah.
So that changed.
And you were producer on that show, correct?
Yes.
What was the difference for you just being a writer from Animaniacs or Tiny Toons to being, wow, you're a producer, you're a head guy almost?
Yeah, Paul and myself and Tom Ruger in the first season, and then Paul and I and Rich Ahrens, who was the producer in the second season, worked pretty closely together. We would, you know, we'd spot music for the show with, I think Richard Stone did music for him, Tim and Julie Bernstein, Tim Kelly. We had a lot of great music people. We still had large orchestras that we were able to call upon. So we'd spot there, you know, you'd do sound effects, and then there'd be what's known as the final mix, where you'd go in and they would set the levels for the voices and all the sound effects and the music. So that was, you know, with a writer, you know, you tend to go home earlier.
Yeah.
And, when you're a producer, you see it through all the way to the end. And that's pretty satisfying in its own way.
In Freakazoid, what I like is every single time you see him smile or something, I believe in the first episode, there's a lot of violins at the end with Cave Guy. And when you wrote Cave Guy, did you say, I want this guy to have to talk like he's a rich person?
Yeah.
Was that and with Mumfrey and having cameos like you did in the first episode with Batman? He's on another network, or having the announcer read for you, basically.
Yeah, we just played around. I mean, I thought Cave Guy, I thought a Thurston Howell from Gilligan's Island, that sort of voice. Jim Backus was the actor, that sort of played against his look, and that might be, might get a few laughs. And then Batman, we were doing that then, and I think in that episode we gave the announcer a little bit more of a role. We thought it'd be fun to kind of play around with that and see where he could fit in and just do different things. And Joe Leahy, who was the announcer, was just great. He was a skilled actor and, talented guy. He'd been around a long time. So he was just great. He jumped right in on it.
I was watching the DVD a couple of days ago. And I saw it on commentary. I was hearing it on commentary, and I heard that you guys had when Dexter's calling for some date on the prom. There's three girls. Two of those were only used on one episode. Was that the same that they were from the original design, or you didn't have time to put them in there, or you just wanted Steph just to be the main girl?
Yeah, really, that would require far more planning
than
we're capable of. Yeah, I always thought it was like a Betty Veronica thing from, the Archie comics, where you have the dark beauty and the wholesome all-American gal. But it just ended up that Steph ended up getting the call for the rest of the episode.
Yeah.
I don't think we used that the dark-haired chick again, but which we should have. But anyway, it just, Tracy Rowe, I think, was the actress who played Steph. She was great, very, a lot of fun, and just went along with it, and so we just try and write situations that would put her on the spot, hopefully.
Very cool. I have film class in my high school, and we had to say, some people were talking about some cartoons. They say, this cartoon has great writing, this cartoon has other great writing. I said, if I show you this cartoon, would you mind giving me an A? She's like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll give you an A, if it's good writing. Folks, I went on YouTube on school property and typed in Dance of Doom or any John McCann or Paul Rugg stuff, and it popped up just Dance of Doom, and this teacher gave me an A+. Everyone got mad at me, and they said, you picked the old cartoon. I said, it's an old cartoon, but you get the jokes now when you're older. And you get the eating on the same plate as David Lee Roth. Most people, like 3 out of 5 people, were like, what? I don't get it. But you don't have to get it. It's funny. So what was it like when you worked on the first draft and you see it on TV, or you hear about it, that it's on TV? How is that? What is that? Is it satisfactory for you? Is it like, yes, I did a good show? Or were you like, I could do better?
Well, at the time, you got to remember, you've seen it. If you're producing it, you've seen it umpteen times. You've seen it in editing. You've seen it in, music spotting. You've seen it in the mix. You've just seen it so many times that, when you see it on TV the first time, all you can see are the, things you screwed up or flaws or things like that you might have fixed. I think over time, you look at them, you can appreciate them for what they were and, enjoy it. And, I like Dance of Doom. I thought I can look at it and smile now and not say I should have turned up the sound on that or whatever.
There are, I shouldn't trust this, but I read on Wikipedia that Lord Bravery was meant to represent you. That they said that Lord Bravery was meant to be, to look just like you, except British.
Well, and not as good looking. So, But yes, Mitch Schauer, who was a first season director, drew a caricature of me.
Mm-hmm.
So that I was Lord Bravery, and Jeff Glenn Bennett was the voice, and he did it like John Cleese sort of voice. And then Paul wrote most of those, I think.
Well, but, and The Huntsman as well. I like that you guys put, it was a freakazoid show, but you had more things. You had Lord Bravery, you had The Huntsman, you had the gnomes, you had other stuff. Did you guys do that in the second season, or did the powers that be say, no, you have to have a whole 30-minute show?
Well, they never, got that far down. They just said, if you want a second season, you got to have half-hour episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a financial thing, too, because, at the time, everything had to be, everything was 2D animation and had to be shipped overseas, and it's less expensive to send a half-hour show to be animated than it was to send these small little sketches a la carte, to be put together. So as far as the other characters go, they showed up in cameos a couple of times, but there was never an episode built around them. We figured, if it's got to be Freakazoid half hours, it better be something containing Freakazoid.
Yes, sir. And what you guys did, I believe, in the first season, I'm not sure if you guys did it in the second season, I believe episode two, you would put scenes from different shows, like F Troop, or you would put scenes from, Scream, there's a lady screaming, or a flower scene or something like that. Was that your idea particularly?
Not mine. We sort of came up with it, thought this would be funny to put some live action footage in. And we had a catalog there of movies that Warner Brothers owned the rights to. So it wouldn't cost anything to put in the woman screaming, because I think that's from House on Haunted Hill, some old 1950s horror film that they owned. So we could use her, and did over and over again. It was just kind of funny to break it up and use different stuff. It was like the chimpanzee in the main title.
And that was real. You guys went to the zoo and took footage of that, I heard, on the documentary. When you guys had the DVD. I heard that you guys, Tom Ruger said that he went with you or Paul Rugg, I think, and took footage of the chimp.
Wow. I don't remember that.
Oh, you
take your word for it.
Yeah, that's what I heard. So, I did my research. I did my research. FYI.
Well, sounds like it. Yes. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they could have picked up. Warner Brothers probably had a ton of chimp stuff somewhere. But anyway, yeah, it. That sort of gave us the idea to, try putting live action stuff. Mixed in.
Did you guys want to always make fun of something? Like, I know that. I haven't talked to Paul Rugg yet. I'm trying to get a interview with him, but he's hard to get. I heard that he did the with the rating system. You guys made fun of the, what's it called, the sponsors, or you guys made fun of the WB. Why do you guys want to do that? You just said, oh, forget it. We'll just tease and make a little fun of them, or you just say, let's just make a joke about them.
Yeah, I mean, we did, the marketing at Warner Brothers didn't know quite how to market Freakazoid.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what age group to, have the products aimed at.
We interrupt our regularly scheduled program to bring you this special report from the WB Network.
What exactly is the WB? Can someone tell me this? What's it mean, the WB? The water bucket? The wimpy boy? The wet bananas? I don't know what! The weird butt? What? I'm asking!
This has been a special report from the Weird Butt Network. We now join Freakazoid, already in progress.
They didn't appreciate that. I think they wanted something more definitive. But I remember they used... they would use words like marketing words like, oh, that's very toyetic. Now, we had no idea what that meant. We asked them. They said it was, something that could be rendered into a toy. So I know in one episode I made fun of, Toyetic and
oh yeah, yeah. You made a commercial, the Freakmobile. On the Fanboy episode.
And then Paul did that thing about the motion picture rating, and we actually got Jack Valenti to do the voice, who had been the head of the motion picture rating system.
Mm-hmm.
So he had been in charge of that for years. So he came in and did the voice for us.
How difficult or when you got the cameos, you would get cameos for actors as Cosgrove, you would do Ed Asner. How difficult, was it difficult to get him, or would you say, hey, please, you have to just be in this episode, and then turns out he's in first season and second season?
Right. Well, he was a, you know, wasn't a cameo. He was a regular character.
Yeah.
I can't remember if there was anything like him in the first, in the model packs that we had to work with, but he was, I think Andrea Romano, who was our voice director, I think she cast him. And, you know, a lot of these guys, actors, you know, even big name actors are always, they always want to be working.
Yeah.
So a lot of them do voices, animation, what have you. And so he came in and he just, you know, his reading was in such a contrast to Freakazoid that he was the perfect foil to have as a partner for him. You know, that the Freakazoid's closest chum is this, you know, kind of dry 45-year-old cop.
Yeah.
You know, it just seemed appropriate for it. But they all had fun, you know. They got into the spirit of things and had a good time.
Do you see sometimes, I'm not sure if you go to comic book conventions. We have a comic book convention here downtown every year. And what was it, last year, there was a guy dressed as Freakazoid. Like, I'm not kidding. Like, red tights, F and everything, and hair. And I told him if he knew the show. He goes, yeah, I'm doing a petition. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm doing a petition at the Hub. The Hub was coming out with Tiny Toons Animaniacs. He had 1,000 signatures to put Freakazoid on. But it turned out it never happened. It turned it down, unfortunately.
Well, you know, bless his heart for trying.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. But yeah, I would see people like that. I go to Comic-Con in San Diego every now and again. And you'll see people down there dressed up. And I think the year the DVDs came out, 2008, we had a big panel down there with Bruce Timm and Andrea Romano and Rich Ahrens, Paul Dini, Paul Rugg, and myself, you know, just talking about the evolution of Freakazoid and what it became. And it was a big, we had a pretty good crowd down there. So we signed some posters afterwards, and there were a couple of people with Freakazoid, either not full freak, they didn't have their full freak on, but they had, you know, a sort of demi-freak look, you know, where they'd have eyes, raccoon eyes or something like that. But it was fun to see. It was fun to see.
When you were about to just finish Freakazoid, were you like, oh, we should have got another chance, or the powers that be don't understand us, or what was your feeling on that, that you were about to get canceled?
Well, I think we thought if they canceled us, maybe we could get, you know, fired up on another, you know, fired up on Cartoon Network. Maybe they would buy some episodes. And I remember we, you know, broached it with Steven Spielberg, but by then he was the competition at DreamWorks, so he couldn't really help us at the time. So, you know, at the time there wasn't much we could do. You know, it's not like now where, you know, it looked like shows like, I think it was Family Guy and, you know, others, Futurama maybe, where there were campaigns to, you know, keep these shows on the air.
Yeah.
And they were able to do that because of the technology. And, you know, it was really just getting underway back then. So that was it. We had a bid farewell and hope we could find something to work on. Quick.
Man, if the internet existed, you would have a big boom. If the internet existed back then, a lot.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's so much different now. And, you know, just the immediacy and the fact that they listen to this, if you get enough people.
Yeah. Believe it or not, what was it? I think when that show came out, I wasn't that that old. I was like only 4 months when that program came out. And my brother told me, he used to watch that show with me all the time. And I told him, I'm doing this thing with John P. McCann. He goes, who's John P. McCann? He wrote the Freakazoid show. He goes, you have to tell him I say hi. So Blake Gomez says hi.
Give him my best.
No problem.
I'm glad he watched.
Oh, yeah, he watched all the time. My brother, JJ, as well, used to watch. And then everyone else, there's only people my age, like 18, know about it. I told a 16-year-old Freakazoid. He said, what's Freakazoid? I gave him a DVD. He just watch it.
School that kid.
Yes, sir. Stone Cold. I gotta help your reputation here.
Thank you.
No problem. What is the difference between comedy that you do for improv comedy when you did back in Acme to just say, okay, I have to make something that's funny, but it's for kids?
Well, I don't think we ever thought of it in that regard.
Yeah.
We just, for the TV animation, we just try to make it as funny as we could within bounds. We'd hope that the younger kids would enjoy the action,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the fun stuff going on, and that older kids and their parents, if they were watching, they'd have some jokes in there that they liked. With improv, it's the immediacy. In other words, with animation back then, it might be 6-7 months. You do something before anyone actually saw it, other than everyone who worked on it.
Yeah.
Whereas improv comedy, they're right there. They're waiting. So, you got to deliver.
Cool. On the behind the scenes that you had on the DVD, sorry, going back to that, you said that you guys were sometimes distracted. Like there was I'm not sure if it was a joke or not, some dude who ate a whole ham, like a python.
Yeah, that was a joke.
All right, because my friends and I were talking, I said, if a guy does that, he'll die, don't you think? Like, yeah, he will die. I'm like, ask him. Okay, I'll ask him.
Yeah.
So
tell your friends they're right.
Yeah.
You will die.
Yeah, I was like, you can't do that. You can't just eat a whole thing like that. How long did you knew Paul Rugg?
Oh, boy. I knew Paul about probably over 25 years. Or no, longer than that. We were in a different improv group before we joined up at Acme. But I was sort of I was in the process of just leaving it, and he was just coming in. And then we knew a lot of the same people, mm-hmm. in improv comedy, so we'd run into each other every now and again. But it wasn't until they started Acme that we really started hanging out together, which is about 1989. So a long time.
Not bad. That's a good friendship.
Yeah.
Are you now starting to write novels, books, or are you still into animation, or?
Both. Both? I've done some short, couple of short little pieces that I've sold as ebooks.
Hmm.
Working on my first novel right now, but I'm still doing TV animation. There's a new show called Wabbit that's going to be coming out on the Cartoon Network. I don't know when, but... it's sort of an updated version of Bugs Bunny.
Are you working on that?
I did a couple for them. They're sort of stuffed with outlines now, so they're not taking any more scripts. But mm-hmm. That was fun. It was fun because that was where I started, was watching the original Warner Brothers, and they were they were just so much fun. It was great to be able to work on a new version of them.
Cool. How long does it take for you, of course, like with Freakazoid, you're a producer, and Animaniacs, Tiny Toons as a writer, how long does it take when you say, all right, here's a script, okay, and then the cartoonist or the artist has to draw it, send it to overseas, and then you get the footage, then you got to re-edit it. How long did it take you guys? Did it take you guys 9 months, 8 months?
Yeah, it took like 4 to 6 months sometimes, mm-hmm. Depending on what studio we sent it to. It's so much different now with the technology. They can do animatics, send that overseas, and there's so much you can do on the computer now.
Yeah.
That it just changed. I mean, when we started Animaniacs, we still didn't have the, I don't know if you're familiar with the Avid machine for editing. It digitizes film. We were still editing it on old-fashioned Moviola, where they had to, you know, cut the film with a razor blade and splice it together manually. The Avid came in, I think, shortly after that, pretty soon. But I remember a guy, Tim Sarnoff, who worked over at Warner's at the time, was one of the first, and I think it was on Batman, to start digitizing backgrounds and having backgrounds, these dark, moody backgrounds that you could reuse. So he really was, pioneering that sort of thing.
Very cool. When you guys said, okay, let's create Freakazoid, or when did you guys, or was it Bruce, when you said he just presses delete? And I know you guys said with the clicker, what was it, because it was just the age of the computer at that time?
As far as...
like when you, as far as his origin, like when he just says press delete, if this was like another time, like 20 years later, it would be, it wouldn't be like on the computer, it'd be just something different, correct?
Yeah, probably, you know, it'd be something Wi-Fi like.
Yeah.
You know,
Quicker.
but yeah, at the time, what was the big thing? Intel was the big thing, you know, coming out then. So, you know, computers really got their, you know, it became widespread when AOL dumped all their users onto the web.
Yeah.
I forget, that was like 93, 94. But that really started it. Because before then, they had, you know, people had computers, people went on to chat lines, you know, they used DOS commands, they used all this old school stuff. Yeah. But it wasn't until suddenly AOL started handing away 10 free hours, you know, every time you, you know, bought groceries or had surgery, you know, you'd get a pack with 10 free hours of AOL.
Yeah.
So that really kicked started it. So yeah, it'd be something clunky like hit the delete button.
It's amazing, like back then the phones used to be like the, like 4 inches thick, 5 inches thick, and now they're only like this, nothing. So that's cool. But all right, Mr. McCann, we've been talking for about 46 minutes here. Would you like to plug anything?
You know, you stop by my website, Right Enough, at blogspot.com. That usually, you know, usually says what I'm doing there. Or you can come by Facebook, John P. McCann.
And this is the this is the real guy, FYI.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm not impersonating me.
No.
Yeah.
Very cool. We are gonna finish the show. Please stay online so I can thank you. And all right, everyone. Thank you for watching the program with Mr. John P. McCann. I will see you soon. Hello, guys. Hope you enjoy. I had a lot of fun with my hero. John McCann is a great guy, stand-up guy. When I first messaged him, I did not think he would want to be on the show. I had some people I wanted to do, but I was rejected. No, kid, I don't know you. I don't want to be on your show. I'm wasting my time. Some other people would tell me that, people who would not be unnamed. And Mr. McCann said, sure, no problem. He told me to keep writing. My hero told me to keep writing. I'm not a good writer. I suck, but I got inspired. He told me, write as much as you can, and then email it to me. I'll read it. Wow, that is cool when your hero says that. I drew a doodle of Freakazoid, and he sends a message to me and says, very nice work. You could have been with us back in the day. That was effing awesome. More is when I posted online saying, hey, finished second day of school. It was all right. Not good, not bad. But, oh yeah, there it is. And he said he liked my thing. Wow. Now you know when you have your hero. As of probably this week and all the way down to next year, I will be having school, right? But don't think that would stop the Friends in Hell show, ladies and gentlemen. Hell no. Friends in Hell will still continue on. And it'll be kind of difficult for me, but I'll do it. It's sacrifices. Shout out to everyone who listens to me. Thanks, Dad. If you guys want to hear me, please do. Like I said, I would love for you to put some comments on there. We are a small show, okay? Very small, only 4 episodes, guys. And no one's been listening to me. I've been just wasting my time here. But you know what? I don't care. I'd rather waste my time here than not do anything at all. I want to say special thanks to John McCann. Very, very thankful for you to make a 18-year-old's dream. No pun intended, folks. We are going to have... I'm having trouble with guests lately. Okay? I want to have Paul Rugg. Mr. McCann told me that Paul Rugg, we after our off conversation, he told me that Paul Rugg isn't on Facebook that often. And he messaged me. I mean, he friended me, and I'm trying to maybe see if he wants to be on the show. Maybe, maybe not. I will have other people, not sure what if they're interested or not, but I want them on. Hope you guys enjoy. Remember, listen to Friends in Hell, because that's the only place you're going to be. This is Kevin Lomas signing off. Goodbye.
Worldwide. Hold up, 'cause bitch, I'm worldwide.